Hey friends, I just wanted to give you a heads up before we get into today's stories. Now you probably already noticed this video is releasing on a weird day, Thursday. Well, I think now that it's 2024, I've been wanting to make this change for a while now. And that change is from releasing videos 3 days a week every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, to 2 days a week, those days being Monday and Thursday. I've been grinding these videos for almost 10 years now, which is wild to think about. I have over 1,000 videos, and I think it will be really good so I don't get burnt out and I can provide even better, more valuable content going forward. So, once again, the new upload schedule on YouTube will be Mondays and Thursdays at approximately 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and the podcast will still stay at the same time, noon Eastern on Tuesdays, wherever you listen to podcasts. And the streams and live readings will coincide with a new upload schedule, so usually streaming the night before, so on Sundays and Wednesdays. I hope that makes sense. Thanks again, friends, for nearly 10 years of support on this channel. It's been an honor lulling you all into beautiful nightmares. I was a parole officer in the state of Utah for 9 years, 4 months, and 18 days. It was nothing like working as a correctional officer, but after a bad car accident in the spring of 97, it was one of the few options open to me that didn't include medical retirement. A lot of guys told me to take the medical, buy a boat, and start up that charter service idea that had served as a pipe dream for so many years, but frankly, that felt a little too much like giving up. On top of that, there was the fact that if I worked 9 more years, I'd be entitled to a full pension, and I'd have all my treatment covered by the state. It was that last thing which proved to be the deciding factor. So instead of walking off into the sunset with a big check and a bum leg, I joined the Utah Department of Corrections as a parole officer. I worked hundreds, possibly even thousands of caseloads prior to my eventual retirement, and sadly, I think I only had a handful of stories that might interest you. Being a parole officer wasn't exactly action-packed, and it's always laughable when the movies present us as these badass bounty hunters when, really, we're mostly just slow horses with a motley collection of dysfunctional appendages, with a few exceptions, obviously. I think I only had 3 or 4 major incidents in my whole PO career, but the incidents I did experience were just as intense, if not more so, than anything I experienced as a corrections officer, including the time that I almost lost my life to a man who, in another life, could have been a cousin or a nephew of mine, maybe even a son. I first met Sean at the trailer park that he was calling his temporary home following his release from federal prison. The trailer park was part of the halfway home scheme that we were sort of running due to budget constraints, and all that extra freedom meant only the most promising of parolees got to stay there. And then, out of all these promising parolees that ended up calling the park home for a while, I'd swear that Sean was the most promising of them all. He was a former Marine flight mechanic, 2 tours of Iraq before the crap really hit the fan, but even so, the base he operated at got pummeled by insurgent rockets and mortars, I remember him saying, meaning that he came back stateside with a nasty case of what he called the shakes. I guess officially speaking, whatever Sean suffered from would be categorized as PTSD, but for whatever reason, he never called it that. He just said that he got the shakes sometimes when he got to thinking about things too hard. He tried all kinds of medication, all kinds of therapy, but nothing ever worked. Then one day, out of pure self-destructive desperation, Sean smoked a bowl of meth at a party on Memorial Day weekend and found that it actually stopped his shakes. I don't know how something like meth came to have that kind of effect on him. If anything, I'd have assumed that it made his shakes worse, but surprisingly, it had the opposite effect, I guess. He said it focused him like a laser, but brought the tremors down to almost nothing. Having discovered what he thought was the miracle cure for his shakes, Sean starts using a little meth here and there, just whenever things got a little too rough, he said. Then he discovered it made him better, shiny and new, as he put it, and much more able to deal with all the bullcrap of being freshly discharged from the Marine Corps with nothing to show for it but a glorified severance check. He starts doing more and more, a little before work and a little after work. Then he's doing it in his free time, and then all alone whenever he was craving. But then this obviously left Sean with a problem. One day he found that he wanted to smoke more meth than he had money, but he also really didn't want to be that depraved drug addict who spends his last few dollars on drugs. So instead, he goes to a meth cook, asks what he needs to cook him a batch, and then goes around either stealing or buying everything on his little shopping list. He helps the cook with the batch, makes a bunch of mental notes, and then starts with cooking his own, for purely personal use, keeping the batches as small as possible. But just like when he first started smoking, the amount that he was cooking got bigger and bigger, until eventually, he couldn't hide it anymore. Cops raided his cookhouse, Sean got arrested, and then he spent the next 12 years in a federal prison. He'd have gotten way longer if it wasn't for his military background and his behavior as an inmate was impeccable. Had it not been for that, there's no way that he'd have been paroled 9 years into the 18 the judge gave him. But I'm also guessing, in front of the judge, he showed a hell of a lot of enthusiasm for putting his life in order, because that's sure as hell what he showed me that first time that I met him at the trailer park. I thought that he was going to be the easiest case that I've ever dealt with. He was itching to get his life back together. And every time I stopped by his place or we met for bacon and eggs at a nearby diner, his enthusiasm seemed to have only have grown. A few months go by. Sean's well on his way to getting all the early release recommendations he needs, including my own, and I stop by his place for a prearranged meeting, only to find that he's not there. I figured something must have been wrong for him to just pull a no-show like that, and unlike some other cases I've worked, I didn't assume that he was trying to duck me or play games after building up a little trust. I tried giving him a call on his cell, and the first time the call went through, but when it suddenly and abruptly went to voicemail, I started to get this sinking feeling. Best case scenario, he was running late, driving back to the trailer park and didn't want to risk getting pulled over by talking on his cell. But then the next time that I tried to call him, it went straight to voicemail. No dial tone, like he'd quickly just turned off his cell between calls. Again, I get that sinking feeling. I liked Sean. I had high hopes for him. So the idea of him messing up all of his progress and ruining his chances of getting those recommendation letters, it made me feel like a scared parent. I didn't just leave right away. I walked back and forth in the dirt in front of his trailer, hoping to catch one of Sean's neighbors. He'd mentioned borrowing one of their trucks to get to and from his job, so I moseyed on around the trailer park, hoping that I might be able to talk to someone who knew him. I knocked on the doors of a few trailers, got no answer, and then finally, the last one I visited had someone home. I asked if they knew Sean, and they said yes. Then, when I asked where he was, they started giving it the usual, "whose business is it of yours?" kind of thing. I explained that I was his PO and that he wasn't in any trouble, and I wanted to know where he was because I was worried about him. It wasn't like him to miss a face-to-face, and I wasn't making up some story to get him to talk, and I'd appreciate it very much if he could do me a solid and just tell me what he knew. I remember the guy gave me this look like, "You really don't know, do you?" And then told me. "Sean's mom died. He took it real bad. An owner of one of the other trailers was out there drinking beer with him for a while, but Sean was pacing back and forth making phone calls, and the next thing you know, a truck pulls up, Sean jumps in the back, and then off he goes. I ain't seen him since." I asked him how long ago this was, and my heart sank when the guy said, "Tuesday, so 4 days now, give or take." 4 days. Sean could have been halfway across the country by then, and if he'd gotten some kind of terrible news, there was no telling what he'd retreated to in order to cope. I couldn't blame him. But as I got back into my truck, I was praying to God, "Please, just stick to booze, Sean. Stick to booze if you gotta." The last thing I wanted to do was call it in to my superiors then and there. If it were some scumbag who had been caught with some kiddie pictures on his computer, I'd have come down on him like a stampeding steer, but as I've said already, Sean was far from some pervert scumbag. If I came down hard on him over one missed appointment, especially when it was due to a death in the family, I'm not sure that I've been able to look myself in the mirror for a while. And the trouble was, leaving him to his own devices for too long, not to mention in a state of grief, he might not pass a urine test. Then if that happened, he was definitely going back to jail to serve out the remainder of the sentence there instead of doing it on parole. Obviously, Sean wasn't my only parolee during that period, so it's not like I could devote all my time to searching for him. But over the next few days, I kept calling his cell phone, kept stopping by his trailer, and most importantly, gave my cell number to the neighbor that I spoke to and asked him to keep his eyes peeled for me. A few days later, I get a call in my cell, and it's the neighbor, saying that he's just seen Sean and a few others entering his trailer. I thanked him for the info, but before I hung up, he warned me that they didn't look like the kind of folks who woke up bright and early for Sunday service, and that I might want to be careful if I was looking to arrest anyone. I definitely wasn't looking to make any arrests. I didn't even have the power to, but I did want to make sure that he was okay, and if these friends of his wanted to put themselves in the way of that, then that might pose a very big problem for myself. I drove over to the trailer park as quickly as possible, hoping to catch Sean before he did anything that he'd live to regret. When I arrived, all the curtains of his trailer were drawn, and music was so loud that I could hear it as I turned into the park and was thumping out of some kind of sound system inside. Now just to be safe, I put on the bulletproof vest that I kept in my trunk and then headed up to the front door of the trailer. I had to hammer on it just to be heard over the racket, and when someone opened up the door, not only was it not Sean, but they didn't look too pleased to see me. Standing in front of me when the door opened up was a guy that looked like his daddy was Bigfoot and his mommy was a skeleton. And to him, with all of the narcotics in his system, I guess I look like the devil himself. He slams the door closed, and even over the loud music, you could hear him scream, "It's the cops." At first, I found the guy's reaction to be kind of funny. Sure, I was wearing a vest and I had a gun on my hip, but I wasn't a cop. So I guess it was halfway to bringing a smirk to my lips as I peered around to a window and tried to peer through a crack in the curtain. Having these guys throw all their drugs in the chemical toilet would have most definitely been in their best interest, but the fact was, I wasn't there in that capacity. I was only there to talk to Sean. Everything else was secondary, and if they knew how understanding I was prepared to be, then I'm not sure that they'd have reacted so frantically at all. I started to call out that I'm not a cop, relax, I'm just here to speak to Sean for a minute. But it didn't seem to do any good. I could hear the people inside scrambling around, cursing, saying things about the cops being outside. I repeated myself again, and that's when the first bullet smashed through the trailer siding. It all happened so quickly that at first I wasn't quite sure what had happened, or maybe I did and I just didn't want to think that it was happening. I backed up upon hearing the sound, but the shot came through way below eye level, so I didn't see the bullet hole or realize what was happening until the next few shots came through. I remember throwing myself back off into the little wooden deck that led to the door, then feeling almost certain that I'd broken something when I landed on my back and shoulders. I think I must have knocked the wind out of myself too, because there was a second there where I was scared that I'd been shot. But after seeing no entry wounds on the vest and seeing no blood on my shirt underneath, I pulled my sidearm and did the only thing I could, emptied the entire clip into the front of the trailer. There wasn't any time to consider the implications. I just had to scare them into keeping their heads down long enough for me to get back to my truck. I got there, but just in time to have someone shatter the windscreen with a well-aimed shot. Someone in the trailer had a solid view of the driver's seat, meaning there would be no getting in it or getting out of there without taking a bullet. I had to crawl underneath and then out the other side, taking cover behind one of my truck tires. I then reloaded, dialed 911 on my cell phone, and then just laid there, aiming out towards the trailer, hoping nobody came out the door in pursuit of me. Luckily, someone else had heard the shot, so uniformed officers arrived at least a minute or two faster than they would have from my call alone. But by the time they did get there, they noticed what I had around the same time I made my own 911 call, that Sean's trailer was on fire. The officers and myself that arrived figured everyone inside would have ran before the flames got too bad. But from the perspective of those inside, they had no idea what they were facing. In their minds, if they ran outside, they'd have been shot to pieces, but stay inside and try to put the flames out, and they stood a fighting chance. So, as myself and the officers started moving on the trailer, someone inside pulls one of the curtains back, but the silhouette they made, including the gun in their hand, it made them look like one of those training targets. And for the officers who arrived as my backup, they were just as easy to shoot. What followed was another prolonged gunfight, and as more shots went into the trailer, the less those inside were able to put the flames out. The fire grew, and the shooting died down in the end. The fire department arrived far too late to save those inside from burning to death. I honestly don't know if any of them were still alive by the time they got there, but by the time the flames were out, everyone inside were either burned to a crisp or died of smoke inhalation, or a grisly combination of the two. It took the county coroner a hell of a long time to figure out who was who, as well as the exact cause of each person's death. Only one person died by gunshot, and that person was Sean. The coroners ID'd him through his Marine Corps dental records, but determined that he'd been dead before the flames got to him. There was no telling whose bullets were the ones to put him down, either mine or the cops that showed up after, but deep down, I think I know. I think I killed the one person that didn't really need my help. I think Sean would have gone through the grief of his mom's death. He might have gone off the rails, but I think her ghost would have dragged his butt back on them again. I think I should have called in that first no-show meeting as and when it happened, and that way, he could have gotten picked up long before I had the opportunity to empty my pistol into his trailer. He might have gone back to prison, maybe for a hell of a long time too, but at least he'd still be alive. There was a phrase I'd heard long ago that never made much sense until that day. The road to hell, they say, is paved with good intentions. The most interesting man I ever met in my life used to work as a tunneling contractor. I first met him when I was assigned as his parole officer, when he was released 23 years into a 45-year prison sentence, and I quickly recognized him as one of the good ones. To me, there are two types of parolees, the ones that are going to give me problems and the ones that aren't. They come in all shapes and sizes and characters, but you can always put them into one of those two categories, and you can always tell which one they're going to be from the second that you lay eyes on them. I figured Mike would be the troublesome kind, not so much because what he'd done, so much as who he'd done it to. Back in the late 80s, Mike worked as a tunneling engineer for a major construction company in the Southwest. He worked on tourist attractions, mining and waste management sites, even an R&D facility for some pharmaceutical company, and he made great money from it too. But then, one day, Mike's boss tells him that all the work is drying up and that his services would no longer be required. And this leaves Mike in one hell of a pickle, because not only does he have a mortgage, credit card, and car payments to keep up with, but almost a 7-month-long crash into the regional construction business meant that he couldn't get so much as a callback from any other company, let alone a sit-down with a CFO or a workable contract. Mike's starting to think that he might really be screwed. But then, right as the prospects of defaulting and foreclosure are starting to loom large, he gets a call from a guy asking if he's free to do some work. Mike said it was like a bolt from the blue, that he was about ready to dig a tunnel to China if he got paid enough to keep the repo men away. But then the more he talked to the representative of his potential new employer, the more he realized it wasn't going to be like any other job. Mike offered to send over his license number, insurance, and bonding information, something which 95% of employers will ask before even discussing a project with a potential contractor. But the guy calling didn't seem interested. Then, in a way that would have been creepy if it wasn't offering work in such a friendly manner, the guy calling told Mike that they were familiar with his work and had done their due diligence and were ready to offer him the job once he'd signed a confidentiality agreement. In all the years Mike had been digging and blasting tunnels, No one had ever asked him to sign anything resembling a confidentiality or non-disclosure agreement, and so right away, he figured this particular job was going to be different. But when he heard what the rate of pay was going to be, he almost choked on thin air. The most he'd ever been paid for a single day's work was about $800, which, as any contractor will tell you, is a solid amount, especially during those first 5 to 10 years of trading. But the job Mike was being offered, by the guy who didn't seem to care if he was legit or not, was $2,000, cash in hand, at the end of every single day. Mike said it was like a kiss on the cheek on one side and a slap in the face on the other. $2,000 a day was good money. But in cash, every day, it was way too good to be true. But at the same time, Mike wasn't in the position to turn his nose up at that kind of money, so instead of flat-out refusing, he thought that he'd play along, see what the job entailed, and then make a definite decision at a later date. A few days later, the guy calls him back and tells him to drive out to the parking lot of some diner out near Columbus, New Mexico. But he's to get there at 10 p.m., Mike shows up when he's supposed to, thinking that the job is going to be at the diner. But instead, he shows up to find a whole crew of guys standing around in the cold, and when he gets out of his car and identifies himself, someone with an authoritative air about them tells him to wait with the others. And some time later, a long Greyhound-style bus shows up, and Mike correctly assumes that they'll be traveling to the work site. But what he didn't expect was for everyone to be given their very own blindfold. Obviously, this makes everyone pretty nervous, but they're reminded of the pay, and that they can walk away at any time they want. The only condition is that they wear the blindfolds when traveling to and from the worksite. Mike said a couple of guys actually walked back to their cars and drove away, which, in all fairness, is exactly what he should have done too. But like we've already covered, he had his plan laid out, so he got onto the bus, put on his blindfold, and then waited to be told to unmask. Mike said the bus must have traveled down a highway for a while because the ride was pretty smooth, but then that all changed when they turned down what was obviously some kind of side or dirt road. The journey continued for a little while, then the bus came to a stop, but then instead of being allowed to take off their blindfolds, Mike and company were let off the bus, still blindfolded, then walked all the way into some large building before being allowed to demask. Mike said that the inside looked like a warehouse that had been gutted of shelving before all the floor paneling had been ripped up. Someone had already gotten to work digging a pretty deep hole. They just had to wait for the engineers to get there before really opening up the tunnel. Mike said that aside from the real secretive nature of it all, it was a very professional operation. Whoever wanted the tunnel dug had all the right materials and machinery, they just didn't have the expertise. Before they got to work, someone asked why all the secrecy, and the group was told that it was a decision from corporate. They operated in a viciously competitive market, and so certain security measures had to be taken to ensure their employer maintained an advantage. For the most part, this answer seemed to satisfy, but Mike said that there was still a handful, himself included, that had a feeling what they were doing wasn't strictly legal. And he was right. Mike said that he made close to $30,000 before one morning, as the bus rolled back into the diner's parking lot just before dawn, a bunch of federal agents ambushed the bus, dragged everyone out, and arrested them on the spot. It turns out their task had been to dig a tunnel under the border with Mexico, and that their employers had been the Juarez drug cartel. And in light of that, Mike and the rest of the guys that he'd worked with were hit with a ton of different charges, big ones too, some of which implicated them as active members of an international drug smuggling operation. He got 45 years. But that's not really the story that I want to tell you today. You see, as crazy as that story is, it's not the most frightening one Mike ever told me. This one occurred during his first week in federal prison when he found himself a very small and very new fish dropped into some very dark and stormy waters. Mike said that the first week or so in prison was the most terrifying of his entire life. He'd spent a long time in jail that all counted towards time served, but being bused to a federal lockup was when he finally gave up hope that he might somehow be able to appeal on some of the charges. The prosecution painted him as some hardened cartel operative who had put the nation's security at risk in exchange for personal gain. All the cash he earned was seized, and he liquidated all of his assets to buy the best defense attorneys he could afford. But it was no good. And when his cell door closed shut on that first night in prison, it took everything in Mike's power not to break down and weep. You gotta remember, he was only 24 at the time of his arrest, 25 by the time he got to federal prison. I'm almost 60 writing this now, and looking back on 25, you're basically still half a kid. Mike had to have been that young to have gotten himself involved in such a harebrained scheme to begin with. But as even someone with such a strong inclination towards law and order, I can't say Mike's punishment entirely fit the crime. Mike was scared, but he wasn't a dolt. He knew what he'd have to do to survive, and that was to get into the good graces of a pre-established group to gain safety in numbers. He did so as quickly as he could, and was told his timing was perfect because anyone who showered alone became a target for Black Betty. Betty wasn't the guy's first name. His last name was Bettany or something like that, and he wasn't called Black because he was an African American. He got that part of his nickname because he scared the living crap out of people. He was just shy of 7 foot tall, I heard, but a lean $2 and change. He was mean, he could fight, but the worst thing was that every so often, Black Betty got a taste for his fellow convicts. If you were in with a bunch of guys, you could shower together, and although Black Betty sometimes followed and just stood there, watching, he didn't make a move on anyone. But then if you weren't with anyone, and you were one of the stragglers who showered alone, Black Betty would follow them in, and take them, as he said. Mike said that he didn't shower for days, not until he and his new buddies decided to head down to the showers together. When the time came, Mike said that he was hugely looking forward to it as he had a bad case of stink ass and underarms that smelled like hot death. But when it came to heading to the shower block, Mike was told that he was going alone. At first he thought it was some kind of joke, but it wasn't. His new buddies, who all of a sudden weren't acting very much like his buddies anymore, were deadly serious. He was going to go first, and he was going to go alone, and if he had anything else in mind, he could expect not to survive the night. Mike said he was stunned, that it felt like a nightmare that he was going to wake up from at any moment. Only he didn't wake up, because it wasn't a nightmare. It was actually happening, and he was screwed. He said he needed to take a shower, not wanted to, needed to. So he waited until a few other new fish headed down looking scared and alone, and hoped that he would get lost in the crowd. And when I say crowd, I mean maybe two or three other convicts. Aware of the threat Black Betty posed, everyone tried to wash up as quickly as they could, but it wasn't fast enough. Betty had seen them walking off to the showers and had followed, soap and towel in hand. As soon as he appears, everyone starts rushing off, but Black Betty doesn't pay them any mind. Instead, he's got his eyes fixed on old Mikey boy. And when he tries to slip past like the rest of the new fish, Black Betty blocks his way. Betty backs him all the way up to the back walls of the shower block, saying all this stuff that's making Mike's skin crawl, warning him that if he fights back, it's only going to make things worse. Mikey's thinking that there's no way that he's about to just give up and give in, but at the same time, there's no way that he's going to win a one-on-one fight with Black Betty. But even so, the best option was to give it his best shot. And if Betty killed him in the process, well, there were worse fates than death. Mike's back was right up against the wall, and he was about to tell his would-be violator that he'll die before he turns around, when he sees this flash of movement over Betty's shoulder. Suddenly, someone hooks a towel around Betty's neck, and then jerks it back to send him slamming backwards into the tiled floor of the shower block. The impact cracked Betty's head open, and while his eyes were still rolling in their sockets, the guys that had ordered Mike to shower alone appeared and stuck Black Betty so full of holes that he looked like a blood sponge by the time they were done. Before they departed, Betty's killers told Mike that, and I quote, "You didn't see anything," which is exactly what he told the warden when he was dragged into his office later on that day. He was so traumatized by what he'd seen that the warden and his top guys had no trouble believing the story. They knew it wasn't Mike who stabbed Betty over 100 times. They just didn't know who did. When Mike wandered back onto the wing, the first people who wanted to talk to him were his buddies. They showered him in smokes, contraband, and all kinds of commissary. Mike said that they even had a plastic cup full of prison wine waiting for him to glug down out of sight of the guards. And long story short, they used him as bait. Betty wouldn't go for just anyone. Mike was his type, and it was either risk him or keep everyone at risk, because Betty wasn't just a habitual predator. He was an opportunistic one, too. While Betty was around, no one was safe, but with Betty gone, Mike amounted to a cell block hero. It was his arrival that had given them a golden opportunity to take Betty down, as they knew that Mike was the kind of new fish that Betty would have his eye on. The thing was, Mike's buddies knew that let him in on the plan, and there was a chance that he'd be too scared to go through with it. And so, a little coercion seemed in order. Mike stayed with the group of guys for a long time before later being transferred to a medium security prison called Three Rivers. It was there that he served out the rest of his sentence, and luckily, there was no one like Black Betty around to terrorize the inmates. To me, the idea of being used as bait to lure out a human animal is one of the most frightening concepts I can possibly think of. But while I've heard that ignorance is bliss, I think not knowing you're the bait might be even more terrifying. What's worse, Betty's killers floated the idea of only beginning their ambush once he was, shall we say, occupied with Mike. That way, they could ensure that he'd be suitably distracted, but it also meant condemning Mike to a truly nightmarish fate. Thankfully for him, they decided that they couldn't live with that, not by unanimous decision anyways, but they came to that decision all the same. Last time I spoke with him, Mikey was driving for Uber up in Dallas. He said he had a girlfriend and that she had a kid and that he felt more and more like a father by the day. He's come a long way since digging tunnels in Mexico, and he's come a long way since being used as bait for a monster. I'll be completely honest with you. I had next to no idea what I wanted to do with my life when I first applied to university. I'd always been interested in crime and police dramas, so I had an inkling that I'd end up doing something related to criminal justice. I just wasn't exactly sure what it'd be. My mom had dreams of me being a barrister or an attorney here in the UK, but I didn't think that I had the smarts for that kind of thing. I also didn't fancy anything too morbid, which put me at odds with almost everyone else on my course. Most of them wanted to get into forensics or CID, which is where you go to be a homicide detective or join the drug squad. On the other hand, I felt like I wanted to do something a bit more analytical, something impactful but more behind the scenes. I know that makes me seem like some fussy little bugger, and I wouldn't blame you for thinking that. Yet if I can make one little correction, I think I was more like an indecisive little bugger, but a few years of study helped me see to that. The more I studied, the more I approached a kind of epiphany. Statistically, it's only a small proportion of the population that commits crime, usually less than 10% of a country's overall population. Then, with certain crimes, that statistic is even smaller. For example, with shoplifting, it's only something like 0.2% of the British population that account for all incidents of shoplifting. That's only about 100,000 people out of a population of almost 70 million. My point is, it seemed like the best way to reduce certain types of crime was to focus on preventing reoffending, as opposed to harsher sentences for said reoffending that would inevitably cause a person to sink deeper into criminality. Once I'd made my mind up about that, my ever-elusive career path lit up in front of me, and I took my first step on the road to becoming a probation officer. I volunteered with the Prison Advice and Care Trust when I was in third year, an organization which provides support services to newly released prisoners. I honestly just did it to get a taste of what it'd be like working with former prisoners, as I still had a few lingering doubts over whether or not I'd be any good at it. But when it came to applying for the trainee probation officer program following my graduation from uni, the Ministry of Justice practically bit my arm off. owing to that prior experience. I spent 6 months attending a nearby learning development unit where I was taught the tricks of the trade. Then after a series of rigorous computer-based tests, I was cleared as an officer of Her Majesty's Prison and Probation Service. It was a bit surreal at first, especially when I told all my mates from back home about it. They couldn't picture me dealing with hardened criminals on a daily basis, and honestly, neither could I. I did a load of conflict management and de-escalation training at the LDU, and it was all great training that I learned a lot from, but I also heard a couple of horror stories that served as examples of how not to tackle a tense situation with a client. And that's the word we were taught to use, client. Some think it's a much better term than probationer or ex-prisoner, in that it's a much softer, much more hopeful terminology. But it never really sat right with me. Client makes it sound like we're doing them a favor, when really, I think going straight is them doing us the biggest favor possible. Anyway, my first few cases were massively challenging, but after that, I started to get the hang of things. I dealt with a lot of lads who had been caught in one little street fight on a drunken Saturday night. They weren't hardened criminals, and the last thing they ever wanted was to go back to prison, so getting them into work and sticking to routines we'd laid out was easy. Then, there were people who were in prison for dealing drugs. Blokes who had been in for lengthier stretches sometimes seemed like they genuinely wanted to get out of the game, but the ones who'd been in for 3 or 4 months for selling cannabis, you knew that they were going straight back to dealing no matter what you said or did for them. I had this one lad who said that he'd signed up to do bicycle deliveries for Uber Eats. I personally saw him whizzing all over town on 2 different occasions. I'd literally never seen anyone so keen on getting back into work. But then, when I checked with Uber Eats and gave them the bogus courier ID that he'd given me, I discovered that he must have done a grand total of 2 or 3 deliveries before he started using his big green delivery back as essentially a cover to go back to dealing. For the most part, that was about as exciting as it got. Clients trying to give you the runaround, having to chase down where they are and what they're doing. But I quickly came to prefer that more mundane sort of work, as the alternative was much, much worse. Every so often, I was given one of 2 cases. A sex offender, or a murderer. There were exceptions here and there, but when you're around someone who's taken a life, it's like there's a heaviness in the room. I'm not talking about people convicted of things like manslaughter or death by dangerous driving, who are, more often than not, haunted by the people whose lives they've taken until the day they die. I'm talking about murderers, people convicted of killing in cold blood, or for money, or just for the sick, bloody thrill of it. 1 or 2 of them, I'd have never have guessed that they were a killer without having seen their case file, and I think they were the creepiest of the lot because you could see why someone might trust them enough to put themselves in a vulnerable position. But the single creepiest client I've had so far was a sex offender. Now don't get me wrong, they're all frightening people in their own way, but they're especially frightening if the offense has anything to do with children. Obviously, I wasn't dealing with child killers or dangerous predators against children because they tend to get whole life tariffs and therefore no probation. But some of the clients that I did deal with who had been to prison for these offenses were just as sick, just as predatory, and just as creepy as the ones who'd killed. They just never crossed that line and took a life. I was about 2.5 years into my career when my boss dropped by my desk with a caseload for me to work through. A caseload contains anywhere from a handful of cases to 2 dozen of them, sometimes even more. You can generally count on a bigger caseload to include a lot of low-priority clients, i.e. those released after serving sentences for relatively minor offenses. You could get a drink-driving case, maybe someone who perjured themselves in court, which happens a lot more than you'd think, and all you had to do was stop in with them every so often, have a chat and a cup of tea, and they'd always be sticking to their post-release goals and all of that. It'd be a time-consuming caseload, but generally not a stressful one. The stressful ones came when a caseload was only 3 or 4 files deep, and if it was that small, you knew what to expect. Murderer or sex offender, and this caseload was no different. There were 4 cases, a murderer, a second murderer, a third murderer, and a sex offender. As usual, my heart sank when I saw the words on that fourth file. Like I said, dealing with these type of people is always an unpleasant experience, but when the offense is related to the abuse or exploitation of children, it's doubly skin-crawling. With some clients, it pays to be emotional, because when they see that you really give a toss about them, that they're not just a number or a statistic to you, they start to give a toss too. But every time I walked into a room with a convicted sex offender, I had to leave my emotions at the door. It's not exactly an unconscious act either. In the past, I've had to actively pretend that the person in front of me was no different than any other client. I made no reference to what they'd done, focused entirely on their future, and kept whatever they'd been convicted of completely out of my head. Because if even just for one small second you remind yourself that they preyed on a child, you just can't do your job anymore. And it's the process of switching off my emotions that I found myself repeating one morning on my first visit to the offender that I'd been assigned to. Now, I'd get the sack if I'd use this bloke's real name, so I'll just call him Jimmy. Because as repulsive as it is, this bloke had a very weirdly similar vibe to Jimmy Seville. He didn't have the hair or the chains or the tracksuit, nothing like that, but he had this let's be friends kind of vibe to him, along with this air of arrogance, like he'd forgotten where he'd just come from and why. He was in his 50s and looked relatively harmless at first glance, but once you knew what he'd been convicted of, you realized just how dangerous he really was. Back when he was in his 20s, Jimmy had been working for a painting and decorating firm and drove a small three-wheeler van from job to job. One day, he sees an 11-year-old girl playing in the street with her mates after school. He calls her over and starts offering to teach her to smoke. Wild thing to do in this day and age, but it was the 70s back then, so a very different time. Anyway, the girl says yes to the offer of being taught how to smoke because, again, different time, but is scared that her mom will see. Jimmy then gets her in his van and drives her off somewhere secluded, but then he doesn't try to teach the girl to smoke. Instead, he tried to teach her to do something else. When the girl refused, Jimmy tied her up, beat the girl black and blue, and then kicked her out of his van and drove off. The girl walked 2 miles back into town, binding still around her wrists, and went straight to the nearest police station to make a report. Jimmy was convicted on the testimony of the girl, her friends, and a passerby who'd said that they'd heard a girl crying in the parked van, but didn't think anything of it until the police made an appeal for information. That, along with a trove of indecent images found in his flat, landed Jimmy with almost 50 years in prison for each separate offense, and he got out after 35. My first meeting with him was the same as any other, a basic introduction to myself and the probation scheme, then a rough outline of what would be expected of him over the months to come. Obviously, clients are sometimes restricted from going near certain places, and in Jimmy's case, he was barred from anywhere where there'd be kids. But then the probation service very much takes a busy hands or happy hands approach to rehabilitation, and the way you keep a person from being tempted to go to said places is to make sure that they've got hobbies. I know it sounds daft, giving this creep a jigsaw puzzle and he'll stop wanting to touch kids, but they've done studies on it. And if you keep these people occupied, if you can tire them out entirely mentally or physically, the risk of long and short-term reoffending drops by 50%, which in our game is a significant number. So, on the first visit, when it came to briefly covering the whole hobbies thing, Jimmy mentioned that he'd taken up sketching in prison, and that he'd continued it post-release as it kept his head straight, as he put it. I then asked if he had any drawings to show me, and he said that he did. A lot of blokes will make out that they've got a hobby, or that they've taken up running, or any number of things, but when you call them on it, they've yet to pick up the trainers, or yet to sign up for XYZ because they've been oh so busy post-release. But then Jimmy got up, walked over to the little coffee table in his living room, and then brought back a sketchbook of things that he'd been working on. He opened up the book, and right away, I was struck by how bloody good he was. There were all these horses, amazingly drawn ones too, in all kinds of different poses. I asked Jimmy if he liked horses, and he told me, "Not really, they're just the hardest thing to draw. Draw a horse and you can draw a human, no problem." He mentioned a few other things about form and curvature, but I wasn't really listening at that point. I was completely dumbfounded by how good his drawings were. But then, considering that he'd been practicing for the better part of 2 decades, he was exactly as good as he should have been. Still, though, I was awfully impressed, and if he already had a hobby boxed off, then it made my job a lot easier if I could just use the drawing as proof of his extracurricular activities. It also gave me huge peace of mind, too, because offenders have a recidivism rate that floats around 15%, depending on which studies you read. And that's always in the back of your mind when you're dealing with them. It could be your actions or your observations that send them back to prison before they get a chance to reoffend, but then obviously, that's a hell of a lot of pressure. Having a serial shoplifter go back on the rob and the Gordon's Gin Company loses a tenner. Have a kid toucher reoffend and the victim deals with it for years, possibly even for the rest of their lives. I kept a close eye on Jimmy, and although I won't say where, I managed to get him back into work. Everything appeared to be going okay, and for a while I was half convinced that he really did want to go back on the straight and narrow. But at the same time, there were other things that made me suspect that he hadn't quite turned over a new leaf. He seemed to be trying a bit too hard to convince me that he was ready to live a normal life, and then whenever something in our discussions didn't go his way, it was like you saw his fake happy-go-lucky persona drop for a second, and you saw the real Jimmy underneath. It was that duplicity that made me want to keep a closer eye on him, and in situations like that, the devil can quite literally be in the details. For example, the halfway house we placed Jimmy in was in this big old Georgian-looking building, and each of the rooms had these floor-to-ceiling windows. This meant that, on the way in to have a chat with him, I could actually see into the living room of Jimmy's little flat there before I got to the front door. And then one day, as I'm walking in to see him, I spy him through the window doing another one of his drawings. But then, instead of a book with a gray cover like the one he'd showed me during the first visit, I could quite clearly see that the book that he was drawing in then had a sort of pinky purple cover. I think if it had been any other color, I might have missed it, but the distinctive hue just so happened to catch my eye. Once I was inside, it was down to emotionless business as usual. But then, just as I was leaving, I asked him, "Moved on to a new sketchbook, huh?" But instead of showing me his latest work, he gave me this confused look and then told me, "No, I'm still working on the same one." I told him I was quite certain that he'd been drawing in a pink sketchbook as I caught a glimpse of him on the way in, but with the same bewildered expression, Jimmy claimed to have no idea what I was talking about. I knew that he'd been drawing in a different colored sketchbook. There was no way that I was mistaken. So I reminded him that hiding things or engaging in any kind of duplicity whatsoever was a very bad look for someone in his position. He put on that "let's be friends" attitude again, and then invited me to search the flat for any sign of this non-existent pink sketchbook. I didn't call his bluff, not right away. If he was confident enough to invite me to search his flat, then he probably had a very effective hiding place. And although I had next to no idea what was in it, I knew at that point I had to find it. As I said earlier, if a client displays any kind of duplicitous behavior, it can speak volumes. In the case of that Uber Eats cannabis dealer, the consequences can be minimal, but in the case of someone like Jimmy, incompetence on the part of a probation officer can spell disaster for an innocent member of the public. The only problem was, I couldn't exactly go throwing around allegations willy-nilly. Say I went to my bosses and told them, "I suspect a client is doing something rather sneaky, so I need officers to turn his flat upside down so I can find a notebook I'm not even certain is there anymore." And then the police don't find the book. I could lose my job. I'm not saying I want to live in a world where past and present prisoners don't have any rights and are denied a chance to turn their lives around. I respect the fact that I needed evidence of my suspicions. But sometimes, bridging the gap between suspicion and accusation can be very frustrating indeed, especially when it comes to someone as downright cunning as Jimmy. It took about 6 or 7 weeks before I was able to catch him drawing in that little pink book again. I was in my car, binoculars in hand, which, by the way, was about the only time I ever felt like the trench coat wearing noir detective that I'd always dreamed about and read about when I was a kid. Then, once I was satisfied that he was using his little pink book, I gave him a quick call on my mobile as I continued to watch him. He actually jumped when he heard his phone going, and when he picked up, I saw him do that reverse werewolf transformation of going from startled and moody face to greeting me like a long-lost friend. I told him that I'd been a right divvy, and had messed up my diary, and had double-booked for our meeting the next day. I followed up by asking him, in the nicest way possible, if I could stop by for a chat, maybe in the next 5 minutes or so, because I was just round the corner. Jimmy said, sure, no problem, and then we ended the call. I then watched as Jimmy closed the pink book, picked it up, and then walked off to a corner of his flat before bending down. Next time I saw him, there was no pink book in his hand. Wherever he was hiding it, it was in that particular corner that he just scurried off to before he appeared empty-handed. It made sense that he couldn't hide the book in his bathroom as the moisture would probably ruin the pages or something, so it had to be in his living room somewhere, and it had to be down pretty low. The next time Jimmy was at work, I enlisted the help of two community support officers in a search of his flat, with me instructing the pair of them to pay a particular focus to that one corner of the room. About 10 minutes later, after pulling up a loose section of carpet, one of the PCSOs called me over to a gap in the floorboards and asked me, "Is this what you're looking for?" It was the little pink book. In a weird way, I was actually quite excited to see what was in it. A lot of criminals try to reestablish connections when they leave prison, so there was a slim chance that there might be details of other active predators in that book, which would get me a massive pat on the back if I turned it into my bosses. But if I'm being honest, nothing could have prepared me for what was in that book. About one-third of it was filled with incredibly detailed drawings of school-aged children, all bound and gagged by various means and in various positions. Much like the horses Jimmy drew, the pictures of the children were shockingly detailed and lifelike. Their little faces were either twisted up with pain or fear, or they stared back at their creator with wide, frightened eyes. But unlike the horse drawings, which were so unexpectedly impressive that they verged on awe-inspiring, these drawings made me feel sick to my stomach. It was like I was holding a piece of radioactive material or something. Now I know that might sound a bit melodramatic to some people, but that's what it felt like to me. It was like I could feel all this hideousness just radiating off the book, like I wanted to seal it up and burn it and bury its ashes under 20 feet of earth. Whoever drew those pictures was a very, very sick person, and the idea that I'd been sharing cups of tea with him made me want to take a shower in hot bleach. I only got a good look at about two or three of the drawings before I slammed the book shut. My heart was pounding as I asked the support officers to hang around for a bit, then I gave my boss a call to let him know what we'd found. Seeing those drawings was probably one of the darkest moments of my entire life. But then knowing that I'd secured my evidence was one of the highlights, and it came with an adrenaline rush to match. Within the hour, regular uniformed officers were dispatched to Jimmy's place of work, and he was placed under arrest. Then he was promptly transported back to prison to await the decision of the parole board. Once it was determined that he breached his license, the board announced that he'd remain in prison for the remaining 15 years of his sentence. And that, thank Christ, was the end of my working relationship with Jimmy. Back at 45 Division, which is what we called HQ, it was pats on the back all around for yours truly. I was the office favorite for about 2 weeks after because it felt like we'd achieved something really significant. Everyone, the parole board included, felt that Jimmy was almost certainly on the path to reoffending, and if he kept us all fooled and then allowed back into society, he could have done untold damage to any number of children, including those of the people we worked with. I think that's why the result was received so well. I'd defused a ticking time bomb that could have blown up in just about anyone's face. In a way, that goes right back to why I joined the probation service in the first place. I'd found what I was good at, and what I was good at made a difference. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday and Thursday at 7 p.m. EST, and there are super fun live streams every Sunday and Wednesday nights. If you got a story, be sure to submit them to my subreddit, r/letsreadofficial, and you might even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button over here on YouTube to hear the extra perks offered for the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations located anywhere you listen to podcasts. Links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember, woo, black bloody, bam-a-lam, woo, black bloody, bam-a-lam.